Sirius X.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is running like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, second half on this Thursday. We got a little bit of a delayed start, and it may have thrown Tony Black off a little bit, because he might have heard all of Alan Foreman and his visit. Instead, he only heard a part because he was at the doctor, and he'll probably tell us about it. But I'm more excited. First of all, haven't had a chance to talk to Tony for a couple of weeks. Tony, good morning.
Steven, I missed you, but I listen. I'm an avid listener, so don't you worry about talking to me because I listen to all the interesting people you do talk to.
Well, nobody more interesting than you. the news you may not. I don't know how much of Alan. You said you heard a little bit of Alan, and I'm going to guess you heard the early portion. But then, as Alan kept fleshing out where things are headed in Maryland with this new authority that basically has been created by the legislature, and God bless Annapolis for being as pro breeding and racing as they are. They recognize the value of the industry, you know, to the state. The immediate aftermath of all the evaluation is leaning toward, and everything is indicating that the future will come at Pimlico as opposed to Laurel, and a very viable opportunity for Bowie to be rekindled, certainly as a training center, and maybe even with a little grandstand for a little Bowie racing. So how are you going to not want to win some more races at Bowie?
I love Bowie Racetrack. I won the John B. Campbell was one of the last major stakes that I won down there. And Bowie was always a great place to ride at. It wasn't always a great place to drive to if you lived in Laurel, because you had to go down Old Bowie Road. And there was always some time during a rider's or a trainer's career that they had an accident on Old Bowie Road, a twisting, winding road, two lanes, one in each direction. And I don't know what it is now, but it was an interesting racetrack, and it was an interesting way to get there. I love Bowie racing. I do have a friend that was stabled there that we rode together, and we both had the bug around the same time. Vince McCauley Jr., even when he, I believe, went to training at one point many years ago, they were stabled and they were... Bowie was a training center, but I keep in touch with Vince because we had an interesting careers together, and I even stayed in Maryland, and I stayed at his house until he got married. And he says, even when he got married, he says, "Oh, you can still stay here." I says, "I don't think your wife's going to appreciate having a boarder." So I moved out. We lived together, and Vince, I'm sure he'll be glad to hear that they're going to try to rekindle Bowie. Lovely, great racetrack, great winter racetrack too. Reminded me a lot of Atlantic City's dirt track. Bowie and Atlantic City dirt track were similar.
You know, the winter portion of racing at Bowie, the very famous. In fact, I've put up screen caps of the newspaper, the famous train derailment. Right.
The trains couldn't leave because the cars were parked on the track. See, the trains had an area that they came right into the back side of the grandstand, the tracks. And then they had cars parked on the track, and I guess the cars got snowed in. The trains couldn't get out of there to even leave. And I'll never forget one day We didn't even cancel races. It started snowing early in the morning. Gooey, when we get some snow, you get some snow down there. And Jimbo and I left because we had to drive to Charlestown because he was getting married in 2 days. And we left because they canceled racing that day. And we said, well, we'll get down there a day or two early. We left and we got stuck on the road for 24 hours when I think it's, what is it, 81 or 78. And they finally sent out the rescue wagons to pick us all up. All these tractor trailers and cars were stuck. We were without heat for over 10 hours because we weren't smart enough to turn the car on and off and keep gas, ration the gas. We ran out of gas, and I never forget, Jimbo and I are hugging each other and cuddled up in the front seat. I said to him, Jimbo, if they ever find us and we're both froze to death, they're going to wonder what was going on with you and me, because we are hugging and trying to keep warm. But I'll never forget, and he calls me every February on the, like, the that was like in 1973 or 4. He calls me every February on that date, whatever it was, February 22nd, couple days. We were a day late to his wedding. And that was before cell phones and everything. So they didn't know. We're a day late to the wedding, and they finally sent out the rescue wagons. They picked us up and took us to the fire station, not too far down the road. But those cars, it were miles of cars just stranded and stuck. And we had some of the old guys that were stranded behind us come in our car, and we had all the booze for the wedding. And but once the booze wore off, we were in trouble, brother. You know what else is interesting? And I gotta tell you, 26 years ago tomorrow, Garden State burned to the ground.
Yep.
April 14th, 1977, and we left through the second story windows because you couldn't get down the old wooden staircases. We dropped down to the porch roof and then to the paddock fence. But it's an interesting time of year. I say to all the people when I go grocery shopping, I said, I rode here when it was a racetrack and burned down. I rode here when they rebuilt it and tore it down. And now I do my grocery shopping here.
Well, you know, I've told whenever you bring it up, and it is funny how often that we there's some connection to the Garden State. And I always forget that it was what the date was. That now I'll commit it to memory because of it's easy enough to day before tax day, before April 15th. I've told the story. My father was taking me to Philadelphia for college interviews, and we were going to Swarthmore, Haverford, and Penn, and we got off the Jersey Turnpike to snake through Cherry Hill.
Right.
And the roads were all blocked off. And so my father's trying to snake his way around to 30 and trying to work his way, and next thing we know, we're at some intersection and the streets are all glistening. With wet and there's the smoldering racetrack with that frame, that iron frame that you see in the pictures. And
the iron frame was only the newest part. The rest of it was all wood. The newest part was and I'll never forget galloping back with Rick Wilson the race before they evacuated. And I rode the race before they evacuated. Rick Wilson rode duty roster for Jay Walton. And then we see smoke. We're galloping back. I said, hey, Rick, might be a kitchen fire. Maybe we get out of here a little early today. You know, we just did a kitchen fire, though, not to burn the building down. And he rode duty roster. I'll never forget. I can't remember the horse I rode. It might have been Freedom Train. But he says, yeah. So we went back to the jocks room, and we checked for the next race. And about 20, 30 minutes after we checked, they said, evacuate the building. The fire is out of control. We left the jocks room on the second floor, went down the hallway. You couldn't get to the stairs. You couldn't get to the second story wooden stairs. We went back in, and we went into the rec room by the lunch counter. There's windows. We went out the windows, jumped down, hung down to a porch roof, an overhang. Went from the porch roof, hung off of that, to the paddock fence that was just below us. And that's how we left there. And we're in colors. We had already checked for the next race. And I'm in Mr. Mbezi's colors, Briardale Farm. So we said, well, we evacuate the building. We might as well go across the street to the Holiday Inn and watch the place burn to the ground, I guess. It's burning. it's out of control. And I'm in my colors. He's in his jock's clothes. Jake Need, a couple other guys are in their jock's clothes. We all went across the street to the Holiday Inn in our boots and colors and had a few drinks, probably a few too many, and we watched it burn to the ground. April 14th, 1977.
Amazing. It's, you know, and there isn't, I mean, there almost is not a, I suppose the ones that were brick initially withstood, but so many racetracks historically were raised by fire. I mean, there's just, it's just countless, because they were all, you know, especially turn of the century construction and before.
Right, and World War II created a steel shortage, and Garden State was built in like the early 40s, and they built most of the superstructure from wood, big wooden beams. The only part that was steel was the part in the mid-60s that they put up as an addition to the clubhouse and grandstand. They put up a steel structure, which was tied into the wooden structure. The wooden structure burned to the ground. The steel just turned into twisted plastic, it looked like. And I'll never forget when we wound up going into the parking lot, you would, if you walked up to a certain part, the fire was so heat intense, it would hit you like a blast furnace. That wooden structure went up. It was unbelievable, the heat that it threw off. You couldn't even get near the fire once you felt the heat. But I'll never forget going across the street in colors in our jock's clothes. And Holiday Inn, I don't even think that's there anymore. But we sat at the bar and drank till we couldn't. We couldn't ride out of there. We couldn't walk out of there, probably.
Well, isn't what is Cherry Hill Inn, right across the other?
Well, no, Cherry Hill Inn was a little ways down the road, Haddonfield Road. That was also owned by Gene Morey, the Cherry Hill Inn, and that's not there anymore. They rebuilt different. The whole area has been, you know, developed or rebuilt, and it's amazing when you see how big of a complex that Garden State Park was, because now you've got multiple condominiums, you've got Home Depots, Wegmans, all kinds of Christmas tree store, every kind of store there. And I think, man, this was just the barn area, not even the grandstand and clubhouse, and the barn area. And when I go to Chick-fil-A, I say, boy, this is where the maintenance building was. This is where all the maintenance equipment was. And I always leave there, and I see one of the guys that checks out. When I go out of the self-checkout, and there's this guy, Pete. I say, hey, Pete, watch out for the loose horses, brother, because you're right standing in the barn area when you're standing here. Watch out for them loose horses. They all get a kick out of it, because, like I said, I rode there when it burned down and left through the windows. I rode there when they rebuilt it and tore it down. And now I do my Wegmans grocery shopping there.
You know, I've got to dig up some of my Bowie posts and the pictures that I've got, and of course we'll be in Baltimore in just a few weeks. You're one of the few people, Tony, that I mean is active. I mean you're active enough, you know, that rode that circuit. I'm trying to think of who else would even be eligible to talk about that's actually a great question.
Yeah, you know what? I'll think of some of the guys that are still around.
Well, but which obviously Bowie, Pimlico, and Laurel. But what about Bel Air and Cumberland and Marlboro?
About Marlboro, I rode at Marlboro, and I won a stake there, big stake. I dead heated in the stake. It was the Marlboro Governor's Cup, I think, or something. And I dead heated. And you know what the pot was? With dead heat. Tony Agonello hit the wire with me, and we dead heated, and we had to split a $15,000 big stake pot. $15,000 Marlboro racetrack. But there was a lot of, you know, tracks. I was just talking to somebody while I was at the doctor's office. I said, so many of the tracks that I rode at are no longer here, you know. or they're here and they're no longer racing. But yeah, like Marlboro, you know, Garden State, they don't race at Atlantic City, Suffolk's done, Rockingham, I rode there, limited, you know, a horse or two in Suffolk, rode there a horse or two. So many of these racetracks, Exarban, I said, you know what Exarban is? That's Nebraska spelled backwards, rode the Cornhusker there. And, you know, different state. But John B. Campbell, I was in Merlin, and I was only going because they went on strike at, I guess it was Keystone at the time. Might have still been Keystone. And they went on strike, and I said, well, I'll go down here till the strike is over. The strike lasted like 30 days, and I stayed there about 5 months because I was doing pretty good. And I won the Campbell, and that was Bowie's big race, the John B. Campbell. And I guess that must have been like 80 something. I rode a horse called Majesty's World, and I had won on the horse for Frank Alexander at Meadowlands.
Wow.
One day, and then John Tamaro Jr. took the horse over, I think. I think it was for John Tamaro I rode for the horse for in Bowie at the John B. Campbell. And that was their big stake. That was great to win that race. Not only was down there because they were on strike at the track that I was riding every day at, but I loved Bowie Racetrack. And it did remind me a lot of the surface in the wintertime. It handled moisture, it handled cold, and it had a gray, like, powdery surface that they could handle when it got cold and freezing, and they could break it up. And when it rained, it drained a lot. Like, it reminded me a lot of Atlantic City. If they floated it, you know, it drained real good. And I always liked when it rained and it was floated, because you could bounce them son of a guns to the lead, make them use themselves early, and they would keep running.
I love it. You know, you made me think of something too. You know, we're talking about you know, riders that may have hit some of those spots on the old Maryland circuit. Did you notice over the last month down at Tampa the way Vern Bush has been riding?
Yeah, Vernon Bush is winning. You know what? It says a lot for making comebacks, and it also says a lot for your career. And well, you know, and it's no secret. I mean, he's entered into a lifestyle of sobriety. You know, it's amazing how I got 20 years of my first career. I started in 70, and by 90, the drugs and alcohol had just about destroyed my career. I got clean and sober December 15th, 1990, and don't you know I got another 20 years out of my career? One entered quick. The first one, I started quick, winning my first 5 out of 8 races, you know, and it ended in kind of disgrace. The second one, I entered and went clean and sober. It started out a little slower because there was people saying, as soon as he starts doing good again, he'll be screwing up. You know, what's the use of dealing with him anymore? But it started out slow, and at least it ended up with a multitude of self-respect and respect from a lot of people in the business. And I see where Vernon's traveling that same road, and I always congratulate him and what he's doing. And I say, just take it one day at a time, brother, one day at a time, and it works. I got 2 20-year careers that I have living proof of that.
Well, and you know, he's done this, he's doing this at the age of 60 plus. He's 60, yeah. He's 61 or 2.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about the time I was packing it in at 61 or 2. Maybe, yeah, I guess it was about 62, 63. Yeah, but yeah, he's doing it, and it just shows, you know, you can do it if you get serious and you take care of your body. It's a highly physical, athletic event for horse and jockey, but it's not impossible to do if you maintain a high level of fitness, and you can do that if you're living a good lifestyle. And I'm proud of him, and I always think to myself, just with the success, don't get caught up in the success and let it drag you into any kind of celebration that's not the kind of celebration that a person that's living a clean and sober lifestyle can do. You know,
yeah.
Take it one day at a time. Keep it simple. And you who knows, you might get another 10. Like I said, I got another 20 years out of my second 20-year career, and it can be done. I'll never forget, December 15th, 1990, I had a choice. either drinking and drugging was interfering with riding, or riding was interfering with drinking and drugging. So I decided, well, let me try it another way, you know. If riding is interfering with drinking and drugging, let me stop the drinking and drugging and see, it probably is interfering with riding. And obviously was, you know, don't take no rocket scientist to figure that out. And like I said, I got another 20 years out of it.
Amazing.
And high level of success.
Well, now you got something new to stay in shape for, and that's the chance to win another one at Bowie.
I'm going to, believe me, I'll be there. And I always loved that place. You know, it was a great track to ride at, and it was winter racing, you know, and you got there in the winter time, and that track, they could maintain it. You know, it was very rarely that they had to cancel because of track condition. You know, they could maintain it, but I'll be looking forward to it. And, you know, I totally respect Mr. Foreman, and I'll have to get in touch with him so he can keep me posted, because I'd sure like to be a part of the memories that Dewey created for me and for so many other people. Like I said, the John B. Campbell handicap, that was a big thrill for me to be able to win that on Majesty's World.
Well, I'm gonna dig that up. I'm going to go to my newspapers.com, and I can find stuff like that. And I put those pictures up, and everybody on Facebook, they love, you know, they all relive it with you too. So, Tony,
and I'm gonna send you a picture that I have that somebody sent me. It's me in my colors of, I'm in the colors of Mr. Ambezi, and my ex-wife heard the place was burning down. So, well, she was my wife at the time, and my agent Freddie Krieger Snaz came to see if everything was okay. And there's a picture of my wife on my left side, me in the middle, and Freddie Krieger, my agent, on the right side. And we're just standing back off of the apron of the track watching it burn to the ground. I'll see if I could send you that picture, because a newspaper guy sent it to me. All right there, Steve. You take care. Keep up the good work. I love you, brother. And you put out a good word for racing, and racing needs people like you. You're important to our future.
You're the greatest, Tony Black. Start getting ready for Derby. You got to start to watch some replays and get some. We want some Tony Black insights on the Derby horses.
All right, we'll see what we can do.
Tony, thanks, buddy.
I love you. Take care.
Love you too, bye. Tony Black. Everybody, unbelievable. Had to catch up with Tony, and I always forget about that date, when it comes to Garden State. I never went. I was only, you know, I was a high school kid, a high school junior. But I went to the new Garden State, which was really cool, really nice, really nice. In fact, I went. If I'm not mistaken, I think I went more than once, maybe three times. And the first time, though, I remember was with Tartan Foods, the food service company. They had a function, you know, for suppliers, and it was a night at the races. That was the first time I went to the new Garden State. I should try to figure out when that was. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was... was, you know, fairly short-lived, obviously, but I'm not somebody that, you know, typically would. I'm not trying to embarrass anybody on when it comes to Twitter and social media, but the instant I put up the note that, you know, Alan Foreman was with us discussing, you know, what's going forward out of Monday night in Annapolis, and it just two responses to it. One saying, oh, you mean the end of Maryland racing? No, actually, it's the exact opposite. If you read Matt Hegarty's piece or read any accounts or listened to Alan, you would understand that basically what the legislature was doing was building an underpinning so that no matter what happens with First Racing, with Strana Group, that there's a way to manage the racing side going forward. So It's the exact opposite of the end of Maryland raising. And then another question was asked, does anybody trust the state government? Yes. Yes, we very much. Annapolis thought enough of this and has been supportive. I mean, they're fully engaged in making sure that there's a future. Do we trust the state government in Maryland? Yes. Why else would they do this? If they didn't care, and if they thought that this, you know, that there was no future for racing, they wouldn't have almost unanimously, right? It was one part of the House, it was unanimous, and I think the other one it was 47-2. I mean, this was by acclamation, and from all parts of the state. Unbelievable. I mean, you know, we know historically, like in Kentucky, where you would think things like, you know, things that were racing related would be unanimous. We know that there's been pockets that have actually fought against racing interests. That awful Alice Forgy Kerr. Is she gone yet? I mean, yeah. Could you imagine being in Kentucky, being part of the Kentucky state government, and being against racing interests and breeding interests? I mean, what? How myopic do you have to be, blind without a cane? So yes, we trust Annapolis wanting to do the right thing. And to guarantee for all the people who are invested in racing and in Maryland's future, that, you know, that it goes forward long term. So I we're going to talk to Joe Clancy, not Sean today. If Sean was coming on, and maybe Joe will say the same thing. But you know, Sean is the guy that always, whenever I get annoyed at something, on social media, Sean is the guy that, you know, says to me, what's the difference what somebody says on social media? Just ignore it. But it's hard sometimes, you know, it shakes your head. But yeah, we just talked to Tony Black about Bowie coming back alive potentially. Joe Clancy's got to be just as excited, right?
I spent many a very cold and very hot day at Bowie way back when. It seemed like the most, I was only there during extreme temperatures, dead of winter or like absolute roasting summers.
Well, lay out the schedule, Joe, when you were growing up and your dad, you know, when you guys were on the circuit, lay the meets out the way they would unfold.
Yeah, and I wish I had a little better handle on it exactly, but, and I think the Bowie dates, and people talk about the, old timers talk about the winter dates for sure, partly because of the various legends of people getting snowed in, the blizzards and those kinds of things. But we were there. I'm probably gonna mess it up, but I mean, it would have been the early 80s. We were still going to Bowie at various times of the year as it rotated through, and the I don't think we were ever stable there. When you would ship in, you would stay over on the backside, and you had to walk sort of through the infield to get to the paddock. And in the summer, it felt like you were crossing the Sahara Desert, and in the winter, it felt like you were, you know, somewhere in the Alps, I guess. I don't know. It was just wild. As a guy on the shank, you were just like, oh, my God, we're never going to get there, you know.
That's great.
But it had character and charm and all those things. And I remember we won a nice We won a stake there with a two-year-old. They had a race restricted to graduates of Billy Christmas's Sale, and we won the stake there. And we ran a nowhere near as good horse as that later in the card, who I remember trying. I could barely get her across the infield to the paddock.
That's great. Well, I tell you how we're going to establish this. I think I've come up with a clever way to do this. I've gone to Equibase, and we're going to go. I probably should pull up. Actually, I should pull up your father. What am I doing?
The charts might not be there. I don't know.
Back to a certain point, but I'm just curious about the flow. And
yes,
here based on what I'm looking at here, it looks like Laurel actually got all the way around to New Year's Day, and to, this is 1978, and on January 2nd, they were still at Laurel, but then on January 3rd, the action moved to Bowie.
Okay. The horse I remember was the same horse who won the Tessio the next year. So in 83, Format won a stake at Bowie December 17th. That's the day I remember. So they were already at Bowie in December. You know, so they were at Laurel November 11th.
Wow.
And then that same year we were at Bowie. That horse made his debut at Bowie in June. So it definitely bounced around.
Well, and I'm just looking. And this is King Leatherberry is who I'm looking at, and the act boy, did he start horses? 1,400 starters in 1978, and so January and February at Bowie, and then into, this goes all the way into March. And he was running horses at Keystone as well. Pimlico picked up March 18th. March 18th, Bowie ended, and they moved over to Pimlico for March, April, May, right?
That makes sense. Yeah, yeah. And then you might have gone back to Bowie briefly looking at some dates, and then Laurel. I think it was probably very much subject to change or year to year, and you know, as the tracks, which were at various times owned by different people, you know, applied for dates.
That's a good point.
Things got consolidated, and you know, we were at Timonium in 83. We were at Timonium all summer, like for a 40-day meet or a 50-day meet, I think.
Wow. Well, and here in 78, they stayed at Bowie. They stayed at Pimlico. Wow, they stayed till all the way. I'm into June now. July, they stayed July 5th. Holy cow! I had no idea they would stay this long. Yep, at Pimlico, then Pimlico all the way to end of July, and then right at the end of July, Timonium, July 24th. Timonium started.
Yeah.
And that's funny. And as soon as Delaware opened, King swung into action. He's starting plenty of starters at Delaware too.
And I think it was probably more sharing of or cooperative scheduling then too, where you would see Maryland didn't run as much while Delaware ran, that type of thing, and those trainers moved, you know. Where nowadays our summer schedule gets so crowded. It was a little different.
Yeah.
When I talk about the only reason Timonium's a marker to me is because it was the summer before I went to college. So, but we were there through the whole summer with a string of horses, basically, and you know, ran by the end of the summer. We had started getting the steeplechasers going, so we had these giant New Zealand bred steeplechasers training around a 5/8 mile dirt track at Timonium. So, you know, a little bit of everything.
Well, after Timonium, it looks like in September, the end of September, they went back to Bowie. What I'm missing here is what about What about the fair meets or the like Cumberland and Bel Air and Marlboro? Yeah, when were they? When did they run though? What were their dates?
Time wise, I'm not really sure. That would have been way before before my time. So between Bel Air and again, they would have all been shorter. 10 days, I think, at some of those places.
Yeah.
Way back when, they talk about Citation running at Amity Grace, you know, before you went
That's right.
Preakness and all those things, you know, so.
Well, Alan Foreman was with us to start the show, and we were excited to hear the details of this new authority that was crafted by the legislature. Pretty much near unanimous, and it will provide a safety net, essentially, and a foundation for whatever needs to happen between the current MJC management and whatever the future holds. And this was a very important step toward guaranteeing, you know, a future in Maryland, which is great. And the thing that I was unaware of until Alan laid it out, I didn't realize that the inclination out of these latest stages swung the pendulum back in Pimlico's direction and away from Laurel.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it's liable to change again. I mean, it's sort of been uncertain. It seems really uncertain at the moment, and we all know that's not any way to kind of preserve a healthy industry or to have a healthy industry is to have uncertainty and all this stuff. And I think it's caused a lot of people sort of hold on, you know, what does the future look like and what do I need to do? If you're a breeder, a trainer, an owner, anything, you know, like if you can't reliably say what it's going to look like in a time frame, it's a little hard to have a business, that's for sure. So, well, as you put it, hopefully it's created a little bit of a safety net and they can get some details worked out and whether it swings where Pimlico is back in the mix as more of with more racing dates or Laurel is or some combination of that and, you know, the idea of horses training at Bowie again. Wow, I don't know, maybe. But I think, again, the legislature, if they have done anything here, they've sort of planted a flag and said, no, this industry matters and we're not just gonna let it go away.
Exactly.
And to try to secure some sort of certainty to the future of it, and then you come up with the best, you know, the best plan that works for everybody. You know, I don't know, we were talking yesterday about the idea of a training center somewhere, you know, is that model like Fair Hill or maybe not quite as involved or as higher end as Fair Hill, some sort of if you had some land, what a training center where you were able to rent stalls and, you know, have people stabled there it would not be a bad business model, that's for sure.
Well, that part of it, having an existing parcel of land like this goes a long way. Alan said that, you know, in terms of viable, you know, pieces of property, I mean, what made sense to me, you know, knowing that Bowie is sitting there, you know, ready to be renovated, number one, and then if you were comparing the value of the property of Pimlico and Anne Arundel, the property in Anne Arundel is probably far more valuable in terms of you know, development potential right now. So, as Alan suggested, the immediate thinking is to focus on Pimlico as the long-term home, and incorporate the elements of the redevelopment corp concept up in Park Heights. Instead of being a place that is a center of activity for 3 days, make it a center of activity, you know, for 8 or 9 months a year. It it would be great for everybody. Make everything he laid out made a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I don't know. I wouldn't put anything in pen at the moment. But is there a model out there where? Yeah, more racing happens at Pimlico, but the horse is trained somewhere else.
Yes, you know? That's it. That's what it is.
I think we all know, even in New York, a little bit talking to people there, when they don't have to have a track like Aqueduct open for morning training and afternoon racing, and vice versa at Belmont, it makes for a better racing service. It makes for, it's easier to maintain. It's just in the winter, in the summer, and if you've got, adverse or extreme weather stuff, it's going to be much easier if you can sort of put that track up on the hours you're not using it, and
that's a great point.
So maybe long range, that is a better alternative to racing. But again, I think we got a long way to go to try to navigate how to do this.
Well, the other topic that we can fold in, this was ripped from today's headlines. The weekend passed, the weekend ahead on the circuit, on the jump circuit, Joe. Where are we? My Lady's Manor?
Yes, My Lady's Manor in Milton, Maryland, which is Harford County, sort of a little north of Pimlico. If you went cross country, it's not too far, but out the other side of the Beltway, basically. And it's an all timber meet, one of the historic sort of early stops. They've had the point to points in Maryland, which are the sort of low pressure, little to no purses, get your horses legged up, ready to go for these next 3 weeks with My Lady's Manor. The Maryland Grand National is next weekend, and the Maryland Hunt Cup is the following. And it's a little quiet. I mean, the circuit probably really kicks into gear next week, but we have the full meet at Middleburg or Federal Racing and the Timber Racing at the Grand National. But this is really four races. Again, it's timber, which is posted rail fences, completely different than what anybody sees at Saratoga or Colonial Downs when we go there. The races are 3 miles, paced a little slower. The Manor has a sort of very hilly, meandering course. No fences jumped twice, so they sort of start way down the bottom and kind of work their way up to the hill, make another loop, and then finish sort of through a line or an alley of parking spaces, tailgaters, and sponsor tents and whatnot. Very day in the country type of atmosphere.
The opportunity to it just doesn't, because they run these in pretty rapid succession, right? I mean, the timber season, right? It's as soon as the spring kind of wraps. There are some other timber races, right? But this is the time of year for it, the prime timber racing.
Yeah, especially for the Maryland Hunt Cup type horses, which has become very specialized, and same with the Virginia Gold Cup, which is the Kentucky Derby Day. Those horses, the sport, that side of the sport sort of has its origins going all the way back to the fox hunting days. So you fox hunted your horse all winter, got him, enjoyed that part of your horse, and if he was fit, showed some inclination, then you had the races in the early spring to sort of prove that your fox hunter really was faster than your neighbors or whoever's.
Interesting.
And, like Stuart Janney, the Ruffian's owner, he was, in his younger days, a big amateur timber rider, and he rode his fox hunters, in the Maryland Hunt Cup and in the My Lady's Manor and in the Grand National. That sort of the schedule has stayed like that, even though horses, they probably still do a little bit of fox hunting, but it's not nearly as, I mean, the Manor has a $50,000 purse. You're not, you are making sure you've got your racehorse ready to go to run in it. But Maryland Hunt Cup has a $100,000 purse. So it's changed a little bit, but the schedule is still the same. of those three races being, you know, a week apart. You know, it's basically 3 weeks here in April, and the Hunt Cup's always the last Saturday in April, and the other two back up sort of from there. That timing works. It sounds clear to run your horse 3 miles and then run him back 4 miles a week later, but most of those Maryland Hunt Cup horses, that'll be the only two races they run this year, you know, so they get the rest of the year off. The schedule works. It's a fitness type thing that week in between gets them able to then come back and do it again.
Well, we will watch. I haven't pulled the entries up. Anything to...
What's his name? Vintage Vinny is probably the story. I mean, he's won 2 Maryland Hunt Cups in a row. He has done this exact same schedule in 2021 and 2022, where he ran in a manner, skipped a week, which, again, a lot of them don't do this, and then ran in the Maryland Hunt Cup and has won. So he's won his last 4 races, 2 in 2021 and 2 in 2022, and he comes back and runs on Saturday. And we'll come back and run again in 2 weeks in a Maryland Hunt Cup. And he's 14, which is old, but
wow.
You know, doable for a timber horse. Again, he's very lightly raced for a horse who is of that age. He's probably, I mean, he's adept at, he can handle the, I mean, it doesn't sound short to you and me, but the 3 mile, you know, the 3 mile of the Manor is a different race than the 4 miles of the Maryland Hunt Cup, you know, and he manages to do both equally well. The Manor can be a little more of a horse race than Hunt Cup in terms of speed. Leslie Young has Tom Garrow in there, who comes back. He won the Manor itself last year. Vintage Vinny won a minor race on the card last year, but they're both in the feature this time. Mystic Strike is another horse who's in there, who is also 14. I was looking back at his, he was running a Calder for Phil Gleaves in 2012.
Unbelievable. Amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. So, and then sort of made his way through. He was with David Jacobson, with Linda Gaudette, Dane Kibiski, Kieran McGee, and then was bought as a steeplechase prospect. And he's won
The Manor.
He's run in the Manor several times. So he did win it. He won the Manor in 2019. He's by Smart Strike, which seems to work with steeplechasing for whatever reason. But those three horses should put on a pretty good show, I would think. Mystic Strike, Vintage Vinny, Tom Garrow. Tom Garrow is probably the fastest of the three in terms of years and top speed. But, you know, Vintage Vinny has certainly proven himself. And it should be a pretty good race, I would think.
Well, speaking of pretty good races, let me, and I don't know how much you've done on it. I only started looking in to Saturday at Aintree yesterday to catch up on the Grand National field. You looked ahead to the Grand National?
I have not really. I mean, I've glanced at it, read a couple things, and it's the... To me, it's such a tradition-bound thing. I think it's really cool that, you know, that it's still here. It's not the race little like some of the other things in the world. It's not what it used to be, but it's still such a race that the public stops and watches, you know. And I think that's there's too many things like that are lost around the world now. So I think it's great that it comes back. There's a little bit of an American connection in a horse named Cape Gentleman, is owned by Pierre Manigo, who is related to the Sanford family, and it's the 100th anniversary of the Sanfords winning the Aintree Grand National with Sergeant Murphy.
Wow.
In 1923. So this horse, Cape Gentleman, will run in the purple and yellow, her kind of stud farm Silks, and he's trained by Shark Hamlin, who trained Hewick and won the American Grand National last year. He'd be an outsider, but not, you know, that race is not, it turns into different things. So it'd be interesting to see how that horse run, and be, if you get a chance to watch it, that's at least an American or American connected horse to pay attention to. I was looking at, he never ran in the Grand National itself, but that Vintage Vinny, the Maryland Hunt Cup winner and horse who runs in the Manor, he has run in sort of the secondary feature over there before he came here. He ran in the Topham Handicap Steeplechase over that course, a little shorter, another sort of connection to that race. That race has become a very much a specialized race too, in terms of horses that point for that and not necessarily anything else. It's always fun to watch, that's for sure.
Well, we'll check in with Kev Humphreys, I think, tomorrow, and get some ideas about the Grand National. It's a war of attrition. They'll start with three dozen or so, and sometimes five or six they end up finishing. I did you see that thread that I put out yesterday? A terrific, where is it? I'm going to find it right now. I was pleased that a lot of people reacted to it. A guy from Racing UK, and where is it? Here we go. Here it is. Andy Stevens, and his Twitter tag is SteveOGG, and he has a thread, maybe a dozen or so tweets, basically answering the critics of equine sport. I won't even say thoroughbred racing, because the critics are far flung in terms of their desire to, you know, essentially ruin all, you know, equine sport activity. And he absolutely has a tick list of all of their, you know, alleged, the accusations that are leveled at equine sport. So if you haven't seen that, I would encourage you to read through it. The Grand National annually provokes debate about horse racing and its equine participants. This year is no different, with a minority branding the sport cruel, planning to protest and wanting it banned. Here's a thread that non-racing folk might find helpful, and it's really nicely done. So applaud Andy Stevens for taking the time to address the issue.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it feels like an uphill climb and an impossibility to try to convince people otherwise, but I think you have to. The sport in general, whether that's just individual people in it or all the various organizations across all the various countries that have racing, you can't say it too often. I mean, you just have to continue to highlight the care and the I mean, everything from just, you know, basic care of horses to the research and, you know, all the progress that's been made and everything. I mean, I think you just can't, you know, you have to continue to bang on that point and just, continue to make it, continue to show and tell people. And you know, it's some you're never going to win over. I don't know, but I think you still have to. You can't let it go. You got to continue to highlight how the horses are cared for and how much they matter, and just all the various directions and ways that horses impact people through this industry.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Joe, what's the coverage plan? I think I asked Tom last week. This is horseracing.com between now and Derby.
We will be keeping up with, I'm literally trying to finish the May edition of Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred, where we've found a handful of people who were very involved in Secretariat's Preakness 50 years ago, which is kind of fun.
Oh, very cool.
And we've, one of whom is photographer Cappy Jackson, and we've dug out a whole lot of negatives and old prints that have never been published, which is kind of fun. And I've talked to a guy who worked on the starting gate. He was not on Secretariat's head, but he was right next to him, which is kind of fun. Again, trying to find some sort of untold parts of the equation, which was so that's Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred, trying to get that to the printer here in the next week. That'll be out in about early May. And then keeping up with the steeplechase world, Tom Law will be headed to Kentucky for some Derby stuff. In the Mid-Atlantic, we've got the Pennsylvania bred Angel of Empire, who we're following in Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred a little bit. And Forte was actually sort of, he's not Virginia bred, but he's raised in Virginia. So,
right.
Another little connection to, there's two of the top, three, four, five contenders.
Nope, for sure.
Mid-Atlantic, strong Mid-Atlantic connections.
Very much.
And then obviously we'll be out and about at the Preakness, which is, again, I think it was a month or so ago, we were talking about, everything's, it might be some calm right now, but it won't be come April. It feels like next week everything just completely shifts gears and away we go with the Middleburg races, and then all the Derby stuff starts, really ramping up and into the Preakness and everything else. There'll be plenty to do.
Well, I'll give you the same warning I've been giving everybody. Well, actually, you're not, you'll be there. I, who can repair the elevator, so... You better be prepared for some spelunking throughout the building.
That's half the fun. Is the spelunking. Tom Law has like a crazy multi-floor escalator across the steps, across the grandstand. He has a whole map drawn out on the way to do it, where you can get an escalator for most of it, and then you only have to go up one flight of steps.
Exactly. You go up the escalators on the far left side of the building, then you jog right into that central staircase for the last level up.
And then you
go across the parapet. It's fun. It's exciting. Well, you know what I'll do, because he is such an intrepid type of a character. I'll have him carry the equipment up every day. He can strap it to his back and lug 60 pounds of equipment. No, it's not 60 pounds. But
it must be a high school lacrosse team needs workout, right? You just hand them; they can climb the stair, get some stair climbing in.
Well, Tom is a one man high school lacrosse team. Joe Clancy, everybody. Joe Clancy, 65, of course. This is horseracing.com, and virtually every horse journal in the country, either written by or edited or both by Tom Law and Joe Clancy, and, of course, Wee Clancy, the Wee Clancy, who we'll talk to next week. We'll catch up with Sean. Joe, does he know about me and Nashville yet?
No.
All right, don't tell him. I want to be the one that tells him.
All right.
Or maybe I'll just surprise him by being in Nashville.
There you go. I like it.
All right. Joe Clancy, everybody. Joe, thanks.
Thank you. See you soon.
You got it. Joe Clancy, everybody. And the Saratoga special, This Is HorseRacing.com team. Let's get Jeff Franklin in here. It's about 20 in to hour three, and we got to do our Thoroughgraph conversation and a couple of very good stake races. You know, there's no racing at Santa Anita this week. They're getting that little hiatus. We'll catch up on that kind of thing with Hammer tomorrow, and of course Scully and everybody else and Schaap, and we'll do a lot of Keeneland. We'll have Marty back. Marty's announcement about leaving turf riding seemed to have gone over well. Jeff Franklin standing by, and Jeff, Marty becoming a jock agent. He might maybe you can give him some pointers. Good morning.
I would love to do that. I haven't spoken to Marty in, oh my gosh, it's been a long time, but I think he'll find it a ton of fun, and he'll see sides of the sport that, you know, you have to be an agent to experience. So I'm wishing him a lot of luck, and I hope he does call me. I'd love to help him any way I could.
Yeah, it's going to be great, and the connection that he's already got established to Joe Talamo. So, but we got a few more weeks of straight Marty coverage yet. Keeneland and then Churchill and his 50th Derby. And you know, one thing that we didn't mention with Joe Clancy, the Grand National on Saturday at Aintree, it's the 175th running of the Grand National. Amazing. Jeff, we've got, I think, a couple of very fun races to talk about, but I suppose we should also touch on last week, because, you know, trying to beat wet paint, I don't blame us for taking that shot. And was there any key learning out of last week's conversation?
Well, I think I graded us at about a C to a C plus. We won a couple battles and we lost a lot of wars. The keys were, first off, and thanks to the folks who thought that that Inquieta, you know, she checked pretty hard down the backside. I disagreed that she was going to win. Some folks thought she should have won. I thought she should have been second, but it was a nice price and a good pop. So that was good. And of course, we predicted the coffee maker might not even hit the board.
Yeah,
he didn't,
that's
even
true.
Money.
That's
so
true.
That was good. Kind of disappointed. As the price on Linguistic kept on going up and up, I kept on pushing more chips. He ran a good third, but that didn't pay any bills. And then from the two that I liked a lot, I don't think you were quite as heavy on, PG Weechee and Rum Classic had no excuse whatsoever. They just didn't fire. And so I gave us a C. A couple of good theories applied. It just didn't work out. And the one thing I would say, very important though, Steve, is that in Run Classic's race, one of the theories was that there were a number of horses who had good Keeneland numbers and they could not be overlooked, and they did run 1-2 at big prices.
Wow.
So
yeah.
Theoretically, great, it didn't pay any bills, but, you know, so very average day.
Well, and the Hear My Song, and we've been unable to, I did hear from Billy Stinson, but after the show yesterday, so we'll still try to catch up with him at some point, but that was the angle. I mean, the best races had come at Keeneland, and that continues to be a valuable portion of the handicapping equation there. And interestingly, it doesn't matter if it's main track or the turf. I mean, and just as important, Jeff, if they haven't run well there before, don't expect them to run well now.
I couldn't agree more. And you know, one thing I like about using Thoroughgraph is that it just quantifies it. It takes the guesswork out of it. You know, if a horse is running fives at most tracks and then suddenly goes to a Keeneland or a Del Mar and runs eights, you know, noted horses for courses type places, I'm going to assume they're going to run an eight. I don't care if they just ran a couple fives. You know, they have a proven history. And sure, horses surprise you, and they go to different trainers, go through different training regimens. But for the most part, that's really an important angle that I've employed successfully over the years, and I'm sure you have too.
Well, and you know, we now have a horse in particular when it comes to our friend Lee Einsiedler and his Casa Creed, where it was just so clear that it's a turf course that he just does not travel well over, his form looked so good going into Breeders' Cup, and you thought, well, it's a form issue, it's not a surface issue. And I know there's people, and one of my favorite regulars who insist that's not germane, and it doesn't, there's no reason for it. But there is, and it's confirmation of the horse. It's the way they're built. It's the angle, you know. It's the length of their pasterns. There's so many parts of this that play into how much a horse puts out or doesn't put out, based on how they're getting over a surface. And so, if you don't want to believe it, don't. But there's just there's just too much evidence that supports that, you know, that concept. So enough on that. Two very good stakes. I don't know if you've got – I couldn't tell. You were kind of hinting that maybe you had some ideas of your own, too, in addition to the two stakes that we identified. I thought that we had to talk about the Wiley on the grass, the grade one at Keeneland, and the very good sprint, the Count Fleet, at Oaklawn.
They're two killer races. I can't tell you how much I'm chomping at the bit to watch both of them, but I had a strong opinion on one, and I'm going to be anxious to hear your opinions on the other. So how do you want to start? So do you want me to go or you want to go?
Go ahead. Kick off, and I'll follow up, because I've got to kind of bounce. I don't have a printing capability this week, so I've got to kind of bounce back and forth off of, you know, on my computer to follow.
Okay, well, the Count Fleet to me is a race that I'm fascinated with. It's a very, very contentious race, and nobody's just going to give you a 12-to-1 shot that you can bet your second mortgage on. On the other hand, there are at least a couple of factors that for Thoroughgraph players are really relevant. One is this is, you know, the weights of the race are all over the map. And a lot of the public just tends to bet assuming that horses are carrying equal weight and fail to understand that a 7-pound advantage can be gigantic, particularly those of us that are sheets players might be giving it a point and a half or so. So that's number one. The second thing is, and this is my favorite part, particularly with sprinters, when horses run a top and a significant top, the normal expectation is for them to regress for a race or two. They're paying a price for all the physical effort that they put out in that race. And, you know, this is anybody who's trained themselves, we've talked about this in previous shows, knows that this is the normal cycle. It's a scallop. You run a new top, you need a race or two to recover, you go right back or through that top. And so there are a couple of horses here at decent prices that follow that pattern. And I mean, the obvious, to me, the obvious favorite here is Tejano Twist. I mean, Chris Hartman's just found the key to this horse, and all he does is fire. What a wonderful, honest racehorse, first or second, you know, how many starts has it been, 4, 5, 6, whatever it is. And he's a fast, honest racehorse. But that being said, I'm going to be looking for a way to bet against him, or at least to give him a subordinate role in trifectas and such. And I'm looking at two horses, one that I think a lot of people will be looking at and one that nobody will. So Surveillance at 6-to-1, Keith DeSormo's horse, ran a -3 at Fairgrounds. And what do we expect after the -3? Well, he regresses. I mean, that's, you know, guys, if you haven't looked at sheets a lot, you know, when you see this, for a sprinter to go out and run a -3, that is an extraordinary effort. It's a Breeders' Cup type number, and he did it off of, he is a known kind of, to me, a kind of a scalloper, where previously he'd run a 2, a 4, a 6, then a 2. All of a sudden he blasts through it. He goes through to a -3. He regresses to a 1, and then he tries him on the turf, which has not worked out well for him. Didn't work out. Again, he's 0-for-3. He's been like up the track each time. Gives him like 6 weeks off. If this horse runs back to anywhere near that Fairground number, he can win the race. And particularly at weight adjusted, he's in 119, whereas, you know, like Tejano Twist is carrying $1.24. So he's one horse that I'm fascinated with and would probably be my selection at these prices at 6-to-1 to win the race, or to make a bet on, okay? The horse that I want to know what the heck's gotten into, the old-timer Payne, who has a similar pattern. I mean, this is an 8-year-old horse. He's not supposed to be strutting his stuff the way he is, but whether, you know, Steve just found the key to him, whether he just loves the Oakland surface. I know Keith has been working on riding him. I can't tell you, but much like surveillance, he's got a -3 in recent history to go back to. Putting that in perspective, if either of these horses fire, that's faster than Tejano Twist has ever run on Thoroughgraph numbers. So I've got two live horses that I'm looking for a way to throw into trifectas and such. And after I handicap the race, I must have reversed my betting strategy in the race 10 times. I still don't really know how I'm going to leverage this. I'd be curious to see if you have any thoughts on it. But those are two very, very live long shots at 6-1 and 20-1 respectively. And I absolutely respect Tejano Twist, and Strove, of course, Brad Cox's horse on the outside. He is sharp. He's developing. Only a 4-year-old. He might go to deep negative numbers as well. So the key here is bet the emerging horses, fade to some extent, even an honest resource like Tejano Twist, and see if we can, you know, maybe hit a trifecta or at least an exact the box way out of the park. That's the way I'm looking at it.
And I noticed all those elements, including pain, you know, with that zero and change two back that would be relevant here. Agree about Tejano Twist. The horse that has got an interesting look to him because he is finally, I mean, at this point, after missing almost his entire 4-year-old year and had a, you know, an extensive break, is Candyman Rod has been just terrific. You look at last 90 days, he's getting a ton of pair ups, and if Candyman Rocket can pair up to his best, he's competitive. He, frankly, from a pace standpoint, he sits right behind the speed and gets a favorable trip. But the most interesting aspect of this 5-year-old is getting Lasix here, and you know, coming off that zero, really a quarter, where it's got, you know, for those of you that are looking at your sheets, that, you know, that Thoroughgraph, you hit the link and get the sheet sent to you. When you see that H with the little question mark, basically you're asking yourself, was there more horse to be had in that spot? And he's won 3 straight. And the adding of the Lasix is really amazing to me, that you know, that Mott, you know, pilots sends him this way, this direction. Junior Alvarado, you know, trots along wherever the good Mott horses go, and at 6-1, he's the horse that really kind of grabbed me by the lapels.
Yeah, I don't blame you, and I should have mentioned him, and forgive me for not having done so. He's really the horse that blew my strategy up, because the more I got looking at him, and, you know, as an agent for the times my jocks rode for Mott, I've learned this guy really is one hell of a horse trainer. Boy, oh boy. And if you see on the sheet, Candyman Rocket has improved every year that he stepped on the racetrack. His 3-year-old top was a 4 and change. 4-year-old was a 3 and change. Now he's down to a 0 as a 5-year-old. He's and what I really like is that he's stringing races together now 3 in a row for the first time in a couple of years. So Bill's probably got him, you know, hit on all fours. And another 6-1 shot that we're just going to have to figure out how to make some money out of now, not one, not two, but 3 really interesting horses. And it's beginning to scream to me some kind of complex trifecta permutation. I'll have to figure it out.
There's another part of this. I mean, from a distance standpoint, since they've cut him back to 6 furlongs again after trying him at longer distances, and we understood why as a 3-year-old he was getting those chances. But as soon as the wood was over and his cameo on the Derby trail ended, you know, he did win the Sam Davis. The going, this goes back 2 years, they put him in the Gold Fever, where he promptly ran terrific and got beat by Baron, Butchie Reed. The horse was good right then. But then since then, concentrating on one-turn races, he's won three straight. And, you know, two of those were with Lasix and those allowances at Gulfstream. He comes back here in at Oaklawn, and owner Frank Fletcher is an Arkansas guy. So a chance for Fletcher, you know, to win with, you know, with Fletcher in attendance at Oaklawn. There's other ancillary reasons beside pattern and everything else. I just think he sticks out in this spot.
And, you know, Steve, I think that it would be remiss not to also mention Skelly, because I know I'm going to get emails saying, Jeff, how come you didn't mention Skelly? He just ran a -2 at Oaklawn. He is, you know, sharp as a tack, it would appear. And I can't argue with somebody who makes that proposition. But at the same time, history has shown me, as I said earlier in the show, when a horse goes deep negative, runs a -2 off of even a good base, they generally stall or regress. And I, you know, as a bettor, you just have to weigh the value propositions and go with the flow. He's going to be, you know, one of the favorites in the race, and I'm going to have to fade him. Doesn't mean he can't win. Doesn't mean he can't hit the board, but I'm going to be fading him.
The Count Fleet, and it's a good one. Of course, the other co-feature, the Grade 1 Apple Blossom, ended up with the short field, but the Count Fleet, well worth your attention, and lots of good angles in there, and lots of horses to make determinations on using Thoroughgraph. That gets us to Keeneland, and just swinging into, let me get both of the pages here easily accessible. The Lexington, by the way, if you haven't looked at the Lexington yet, and I don't know if you've done any work on it, but that's going to be a lot of fun.
I glanced at it, Steve, and I've got more work to do on it.
Yeah, it's...
My first impression was exactly as you said. Hey, this is going to be a fun race. And, of course, the horses are always a great time of year for young horses to be emerging and to try to pick the needle in the haystack who's got an emerging pattern. It's going to leap 4 points forward and kick everybody's butt at 12-1 or something like that, right?
Yeah, and you got Disarm that's trying to make... you know, make the way into the Derby field for
right.
Winchell and Asmussen. There's a lot going on. There's also a lot going on in the Jenny Wiley, the Grade 1. This is always a good bellwether for the filly and mare turf types. Mile and a 16th. You've got a lot of seasonal debuters. You've got some international flair with the Moonlight. And when it comes to Grade 1 turf races for fillies and mares, you got your Chad Browns to look at as well. Any initial thoughts in here?
Well, and again, this is the race I really wanted to hear your points of view, because I looked at it and said, I'm really up against it, this race. Both the Brown runners are beasts, and Chad obviously is a maestro tuning a horse up for this. You know, my time runs a -1, excuse me, runs a one on the turf at Keeneland. So clearly we were talking earlier about horses for courses. So this is an honest, honest race mare doing what she loves to do. So already I'm pretty frightened about that one. And then as an X factor, you've got Charlie Appleby in here, who doesn't make too many darn mistakes with horses he brings over. And a lot of people might make the mistake in looking at her 3-year-old numbers as fives and say, well, you know, she's going to be 3, 4, 5 lengths slower, even though she ran well in Dubai and ran threes there. We have to remember that as horses get older, they can get faster, and those fives as a 3-year-old project to right around the window of my Italian and some of the other horses in here. And given the guy who's bringing her over, she obviously is going to be a heck of a factor as well. So if you were to say, you know, pick out a horse at a price that could really have some fun here, I would take Shug's Filly. And I know on numbers she's very slow. Well, she's comparatively slow. compared to an Italian, or, you know, or to With the Moonlight. But Skims has got a very interesting pattern here as a newly turning four-year-old who took up sharply at Santa Anita and yet still made a little bit of improvement. I'd be curious, you know, I'd love to talk to Shug and say, how the heck's she doing? Because this could be one that at a price I think could have fooled a lot of folks. But getting back to my original premise, and Steve, you need to really help me on this. I think that two or three of the favorites are just rock solid. I'm straining to find value.
Well, I understand looking to Skims as a, you know, as a horse that might pick up some pieces late. For me, the horse that is within range and only has to improve slightly and is not going to be any better than the third choice is Michael McCarthy's Queen Goddess. She's 4-1 with Saez, and she's going to sit behind whatever speed unfolds, whether it's Ray Lou on Freedom Speaks, and In Italian, of course, is going to be up on the, you know, they'll look at each other, Ray Lou and Irad, and we'll see who, you know, takes control. But Queen Goddess with Saez will sit a close up third, and to me, is the right horse in here. You know, as Jerry sometimes, you know, says, you know, has got all the attributes you want and is not going to be favored. So 4-1, Queen Goddess, and let me go back to the page and point out what we're talking about here. Pizza Bianca, who's done really next to no improving as a three-year-old. You know, she has had 4 months to get better, maybe. It's hard to, I think you got to let her prove herself. What's nice about Queen Goddess is that she did something that I love. And you've heard me talk about this already in these conversations. If you look in the lower left-hand corner at Empire Maker as a stallion, do you see his TGI, his Thoroughgraph Index as a stallion, a 13 with three-year-olds, and then an average of a 10 and a quarter as a four-year-old? Well, look at that. Lo and behold, last year, Queen Goddess ran four times and ran five and a halves each time. Then she gets going as a four-year-old and jumps forward to a three. I mean, frankly, a lot of that may be second off the layoff, but she's already gotten to the next level. So as far as I'm concerned, she's already competitive with the favorites in here. And I think we'll get every bit of that 4-1. I think people might look elsewhere for value. And I think you key off Queen Goddess in here. McCarthy is an absolute jackal. I mean, he picks spots really cleverly. And it sure feels like off the win at Gulfstream, he immediately thought, and he may have said this to us on radio, it sure feels like he immediately knew to the grade one would be his next goal. And he's proven himself very adept at that. At that kind of targeting.
Couldn't agree with you more. And having known him for, my gosh, over 20 years from Southern California, watching him emerge as a horseman, he's a sharp hombre and a great guy too, by the way, if for those of you who don't know him. You know, one other thing to add some more fuel to your fire, Steve, is that what I really liked about Queen Goddess's last race was that she shipped from west to east and ran a new lifetime top. That is not an easy thing to do, and it does portend a horse that may continue to develop. So, you know, it's very, very possible she just likes things around here, and, you know, to your point, you add a couple more lengths onto her, she's right in the picture. So why not?
Yep. And I also like that in the win, I mean, she in that Pegasus Filly and Mare turf race, she basically did not need the lead at all, didn't even have to be right on the lead. She rated nicely and She did a lot of things that you like to see a maturing horse do. So I think there's a lot to like about Queen Goddess in this spot, and if she pays $10, that'll feel pretty good.
All right, good.
What you know?
So what else?
Well, we might as well stay. I really don't have time to run to Rich here, so we might as well fill out the last couple of minutes. And, you know what you could address, Jeff, that might be valuable? Look, have everybody turn to With the Moonlights page and talk about the international figures that Jerry is making. Because this has been a project of his the last, I don't know, decade, to try to be as accurate as is humanly possible with the international figures.
You know, Thorograph has put a mountain of effort into perfecting their international numbers, and it's not as easy a task as somebody would think. It's not just a question of doing simple mathematics and applying, flag fall to finish, a little bit of ground loss, etc. There are all sorts of track permutations, and one of the biggest things that people have difficulty understanding is that Jerry and his team do mountains of work on track variant. So, and in fact, I think Jerry drives himself crazy sometimes trying to really get that magical elixir when he sees certain things that will occur on a intraday or intraday basis that might indicate a 2 or 3 point swing in the numbers. So recently, and Jerry and I have been talking about this, I found the numbers have been astoundingly high. Got some great price horses, and that's without the benefit of really having some live eyeballs on the races, as we do with, like, say, 10 of the top tracks here. Noticing little nuances like starting gate position, a wind pattern, things like that a lot of folks just don't build into things. You know, like, by way of example, the starting gate is not always in the same place for, let's say, a sprint or a mile 16th race. And people go, what are you talking about? And just say, well, go down and mark the rail sometime and see. You can see there's a difference in the run-up, thus the velocity that a horse, or the head start that a horse has when they actually, quote-unquote, begin timing the race. And something like that might mean, oh, a half a point, I'll make this up. And then, you know, wind can make another half a point and then go on and on. Well, similarly for Europe, Jerry has, he's really interested in applying the numbers reliably and internationally. And so this is kind of his baby. And so, you know, when I see a With the Moonlight running pairing up the 3.5s in Dubai, those are damn reliable numbers.
Well,
and I stand by them.
Well, and we'll also, of course, tomorrow, and I have not yet looked at the Friday. I think I have it here, though. What's tomorrow? Tomorrow's the 14th. Do I have? I thought I looked at Friday. I'm just curious about Modern Games in tomorrow's Maker's Mark.
Oh, you're ahead of me, but boy, do I love that horse. I haven't looked at the 14th at all.
All right.
So I'm sorry I made that.
I find him over, just kind of overboiled and.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I just don't. I don't know. I always go the other way when it comes to horses like this. He's fine. Hold on, I'm going to pull it up. Now I got to see it since I brought it up. All right, here we go. No, okay. I know I have it. I'm sure that I could have sworn I looked at, there it is. There's Friday. Way too much information at our disposal. The worst thing for me is not. Yeah, I've left a trail of printers across North America. Hammerly's got one. Ron Moquette's got one of mine in at Oaklawn. There's two now in Florida, one at my cousin's and one in, under Mike Welsh's desk. So I've been buying printers everywhere I go. All right, Modern Games, off of the Breeders. Last year he got a one winning the Breeders' Cup. And obviously, if he comes back to that tomorrow, he will be very tough to beat, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that's just a reality. Emmanuel.
Yeah, just down.
Emmanuel's okay. Emmanuel's okay. Pleasure.
Emmanuel is okay, yeah. Yeah, and I just downloaded the sheet very hurriedly to try to get some level of competency. And, you know, I'm reminded that the race that kind of stole my heart with Modern Games was at Woodbine. And, you know, that zero and zero and change, excuse me, as a three-year-old, you know, borrowing from what we said earlier, that can project as a deep negative number as a four-year-old. So if this horse has grown and got better, faster, stronger, you know, he's going to be a beast. And he's a winning racehorse, you know, incredibly well handled. So let's see how he does.
There we go. All right, that's tomorrow's grade one. And then the grade one, Jenny Wiley, the grade three, Count Fleet, winning with Thoroughgraph Thursdays here with Crafty JF. Jeff Franklin, good luck this weekend. We'll talk to you. I'll be home next week. I'll talk to you from home.
Great. And, you know, second time in a row, I'd like to say it. I'm so gratified to get the great, you know, comments and emails and such by your audience who are just asking the most insightful questions. I'm so impressed. So I welcome all of them. And, you know, my email's on all the downloads. So please feel free to use it, guys.
If you didn't have a chance to visit Thoroughgraph.com, click on the click here, and you'll get the sheets for those two races. And look at them yourself, and we'll help you learn. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody, and we will be back here at Fairground. Sorry about the delayed start this morning, but thanks to Alan Foreman for the full and detailed update on everything happening at Maryland, and thanks to Jeff just now, Tony, and Joe Clancy. All right. Weekend preview at the races tomorrow. Send you off into the weekend. Thanks, everybody.
It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve 200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.